In the last year, there has been a change in the way I do the teachings that I do around here. In former years, a major teaching time in this church was Wednesday evening. It was that way for about 4 years, and virtually the whole of the church, of the really committed part of the church, was present on Wednesday night. And we started, I remember, in the little fellowship room across from the kitchen. Then we moved from there into the parish hall. Then we moved from the parish hall into here. Then we moved from here to St. Mark's New Canaan for our Wednesday night teachings. But by that time, my traveling around interrupted the Wednesday night many times, and it was difficult not only for the people, it was for me also. It became clear that it was necessary for us to restructure the teaching ministry in a way that it did not depend quite so much upon me. And it was at that time that the Institute was born, and a number of different courses were offered in the winter, in the fall, the winter, and the spring. And then most of the teaching had moved into the Tuesday slots for me, and then Sunday was another entity. But more recently, within a year or so, I've come to really think that the main place for teaching that I would be giving in this church comes on Tuesdays and on Sundays. And I used to do one series on Tuesdays and another thing entirely on Sundays. But I came to think that that is not a good idea. Now, for some of you who are regular members of this congregation and are present on Sunday or on Tuesday or both, it may be some duplication. I don't think that's a bad thing. And the reason I don't is because if you're like most of us, you need to hear something several times before it sinks in. The thing about the clergy is they get a chance to hear it four times, but then they're clergy and need it. And hopefully by the time the fourth occasion transpires, it will sink in. I need it as well, because if I point the finger at you, I have three fingers pointing back at myself. All right? And the truth that I share ministers grace to me, as I hope it will to you as also. I want this morning, then, to raise a problem for Christian people. It's a very real problem. It's the problem that is highlighted today by the tragic accident that I told you about earlier and the death of a young man who had been a part of this congregation. How to understand the ways of God. Now, that is not a problem only for us or even for our generation. This is a perennial problem of God's people, not only of the New Testament, but of the Old Testament as well. And the whole thing is complicated by the very clear statement of the Lord through the prophet, where he says, "My ways are not your ways." I mean, it couldn't be stated any clearer. No wonder we have problems. God's ways of doing things are not our ways. So you and I might have an instinctive response about something and say, surely this is the thing that God ought to do. And sometimes he does it, and sometimes he doesn't. And sometimes people not understanding this constantly wish to judge God by human standards, and that's folly. God cannot be judged by human standards. Humans can be judged by God's standards, but not the reverse. Now, to say that only makes the problem more severe. God's ways are not our ways. It says his thoughts are not our thoughts. I want to begin this morning with a little incident recorded in Exodus chapter 13 that highlights the whole problem, and you'll see what I mean in a moment. Exodus 13. The setting of this passage finds the children of Israel at the end of 400 years of bondage in Egypt. Now, they didn't start off in bondage. As a matter of fact, they started off under imperial patronage. I'm referring, of course, to the fact that Joseph, one of the brothers of the sons of Israel and a son of old Jacob, had risen to prominence in the land of Egypt. And he called for his brothers and their families and his father, who was still alive, to come down to Egypt and to live there. Things were much better in Egypt than they were in the land of Canaan. And so we read that 70 people in all made a sojourn from Canaan to Egypt. And they settled in the land of Goshen, which is that part of Egypt which is today referred to as the Nile Delta region. It's where Cairo is and Alexandria. That's the part of Egypt where it is. And they settled there under the favor of Joseph and even the Pharaoh. But over the years, decades, centuries, two things happened. The children of Israel multiplied greatly. And the fortunes of Egypt were not terribly secure. And it appeared to the Egyptian leaders that if there should be an attack by an enemy from without, there were so many Jewish slaves there that if they joined in with the enemy, they might possibly overthrow the Egyptians. And they became fearful of them and began to oppress them. They gave orders that all male children, infants, were to be killed to slow down this population growth. And at the same time as you have this great increase in population in the land of Egypt, you have this change of circumstance on the outside that made it perilous to have so many people in the land. Well, God raised up a leader by the name of Moses and said to him, I want you to go back to Egypt. I'm going to use you to lead the children of Israel out of bondage to the land of promise. And even though they feared the children of Israel, the Egyptians were not keen on that idea. And Pharaoh simply would not allow them to leave. And you know the whole story, how God afflicted Egypt with terrible judgments, the plagues. Actually, if you understand the whole story of the plagues fully, you'll see that each one was a judgment on one of the gods of the plagues, of the Egyptians. For instance, the Nile turning to blood and being contaminated was a god for the Egyptian people. And you have the same thing throughout all of those plagues. It was a judgment time. And finally, in desperation, Pharaoh said, all right, leave, take the people, and go. And that's where we pick up the story in the 13th chapter at verse 17. When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them by way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near, verse 18. But God led the people round by the way of the wilderness toward the Red Sea. Now you've got to see the geography of the situation. Here is the land of Goshen. This is Egypt. But up here is the land of Canaan. Now, the direct way would have been to leave here, follow along the edge of the Mediterranean, around here, the land of the Philistines in here, and come into the land of promise this way. That's the direct route. But it says God did not lead them that way, although that was near. But rather, he led them toward the wilderness by way of the sea. Now that's the opposite direction. It's a little like saying we're going to drive to Washington, D.C. by way of Boston. It's the opposite direction. But the thing I want you to notice is they didn't wander into the wilderness. They were led into the wilderness by God himself. Well, they hadn't gone very far before they came up against the sea in front of them. And they were in an impossible situation. No place to go. And Pharaoh looks out his castle window and says to himself, I can't let all these cheap labor go. Quick, mount the horses and send them in swift pursuit. And the Egyptians begin to come down upon the children of Israel, who are in an impossible situation. And when God's people are in an impossible situation, they usually respond in the way the children of Israel responded. They were afraid, number one, and they complained, number two. Chapter 14, verse 10. When Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they were in great fear. And the people of Israel cried out to the Lord, and they said to Moses. Whenever I read that, I always tell people that any minister or any leader of God's people will understand that statement. The people cried out to the Lord, but they said to Moses, is it because there are no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us in bringing us out of Egypt? Is not this what we said to you in Egypt? Let us alone. Let us serve the Egyptians. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. These people wanted to go back. Had they already forgotten that they had been reduced from privilege to slavery? Had they forgotten that they were required to make bricks without straw? That they had to feel in their back the smarting of the taskmaster's whip? Had they forgotten all that? They wanted to go back. You see, one of the things I've learned, some people prefer the familiar chains of bondage to the creative insecurity of walking by faith with God. Some time ago, Ruth and I, on a holiday, were in Montreux, Switzerland. And there's a castle by the lakeside there called the Castle of Chillon. And Lord Byron wrote a famous poem called The Prisoner of Chillon. It's a very moving poem. It's quite a long one. It's about seven brothers, and it's a true story. Seven brothers who were imprisoned for their Christian faith. And they were chained in the dungeon of this castle. And there are, as a matter of fact, seven pillars in the dungeon. We've been to them and we've seen them. And they have chains in them, and you can see where people could be chained to those pillars. The dungeon itself is dark. Only narrow slits of light and air come in through very thick walls. You can hear the lapping of the water of the lake against the outside of the castle. It's very damp in there. It's a terrible place. Well, gradually, over months and years, six of the seven brothers died off. Only one lived to be released. And I remember the first time I read that poem, when I got to the very end, because this is the last lines of the poem, this prisoner who had just been released says, "And even I regained my freedom with a sigh." You see, he'd been a prisoner so long, he wasn't sure he wanted to be free. His eyes had grown accustomed to the dark. The chains on his arms and legs seemed as extensions of his very limbs. He'd made friends with the spiders and the rats. And he's just not sure he wanted to be free. Let me say it again. People often prefer the familiar chains of bondage to the creative insecurity of walking by faith with God. Why? Because if you walk with God, one thing about him, he leads you again and again and again into situations that you cannot possibly cope with on your own power. Consider where the children of Israel were. They had the whole sea in front of them. They had mountains on either side, and they had their enemy pursuing behind. Now that is an impossible place. And they knew it. But you see, what they did was to grumble and complain, and they wanted to go back into bondage. They forgot that they were a people of an eternal covenant. They forgot they were God's people. They even forgot that they were there by divine appointment. God was the one who led them there. Moses told them that. And they forgot. And they wanted to go back. There's so many examples in the books of Exodus and Numbers of the experience of the children of Israel again and again and again when they came into difficult situations, their reactions to them. I'm thinking of a passage in chapter 17. This case, they had proceeded further along their journey. And by this time, God had led them out, had parted the sea. They went over on dry ground. They were preserved miraculously by the hand of God. And yet, now they face a new crisis. They are without water. Well, everybody knows you can't live without water. They knew it, but so did God. And this is what it says about them. Therefore, the people found fault with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you find fault with me? Why do you put the Lord to the proof?" But the people thirsted there for water, and the people murmured against Moses and said, "Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our cattle with thirst?" So Moses cried to the Lord, "What shall I do with this people? They are almost ready to stone me." And the Lord said to Moses, "Pass on before the people. Take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the rod with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and the water shall come out of it, that the people may drink." And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. And he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah, because of the fault-finding of the children of Israel, and because they put the Lord to the proof by saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" Now, what was their response? Again, they're in a situation that is life-threatening. As I said, everybody knows you can't live without water. I've been to this part of the world. It is a very, very forbidding place to be. There isn't very much water there. But remember, Moses had spent 40 years in those very places and knew every watering hole there was. He knew where there was water. But they were without it, and they complained against him and against the Lord. And this is the point of their complaint. They said, "Is God with us or not?" Now, I want you to examine that, because that's very important. You see, the assumption was, if God were with us, we wouldn't be in this jam. That's the assumption. And because they were in a difficult situation, they thought they had been abandoned by God. They didn't know. They didn't know. They were led by the Lord into that situation. God did not bring them there to destroy them. Had he not told them, "I'm going to bring you into the land of promise"? That's a promise. Wouldn't you think that somebody would have stood up and said, "Well, you do remember 3 months ago that the Lord parted the sea and we walked over on dry ground. Think how God delivered us. Surely he'll do it again." Nobody seemed to remember. What's the trouble with the memory of God's people? They forget. We forget. Have you never been in a difficult situation and prayed about it? And been delivered by the power of God, sometimes in a quite extraordinary way. And you rejoiced and were happy and thanked the Lord for it. And then a week later, something else comes along. And have you ever forgotten all the times God delivered you before and wondered if God were with you or not? Don't we have God's promise? "I will never leave you or forsake you." Now, there are many times in my life, as well as yours, when it certainly would look as though God had left and forsaken. Where was God when Jean was run over by a truck? I want to tell you, he was sitting there right beside him. Sometimes God intervenes and sometimes he doesn't. But the question isn't, is God with us or not? Of course he's with us. And the whole thing is your God big enough to be God of the circumstances of your life? Not just your own life, but the whole circumstances that are utterly beyond your control. Most of us find ourselves in environments where we're able to control some aspects of our situation, but there, all of us face many things about our situation that we are unable to manage. because it depends upon other folk or other circumstances that are beyond our control. The question to me is God in the circumstances of your life? Well, if you're walking with him, he is. Certainly is. And if you're obeying him, he's leading you all the way. And even when the way is difficult. We don't have any promises that God's leading will take us only to paths of ease. We don't have any promise like that. We have promise that God will be with us and God will in fact lead us and direct us. But some of the time, it may be in briar patches. Sometime it may be along the edge of perilous cliffs. Sometimes it may be in situations of deprivation where we cannot imagine how our need could be met. I mean, I've had that happen many times in my life, haven't you? When you simply don't know how God could answer it, the need. And yet, time after time after time, I bear witness. He has come through. His ways were not my ways. Even when I've had a suggestion for him as to how he might approach the problem. More often than not, he's not taken it. And he comes up with something entirely different. You see what I'm talking about? I'm talking about the fact that God leads us along. And sometimes he leads us into circumstances that we are not able to manage, that call for wisdom or experience which we do not possess, where we do not have the resources that we're able to marshal to meet the need. And we're not to imagine, if we've been following the Lord, that we have been abandoned in that situation. Not at all. We're there by divine appointment. I want to give a verse from the New Testament which illustrates this a bit. It's in Romans 8, verse 28. Most of you will know it. It says, "In all things, God works for good." Now, that's not the end of it. And the problem is, sometimes people stop right there. Now, the King James says, "For all things work together for good." That's a bad translation. It's not that all things are good. It's that in all things, God works for good. And that's a different thing altogether. Now, here are the qualifications. To those who love him and are called according to his purpose. Doesn't say that everything that happens to people is good. Some perfectly awful things happen to people. But the promise is, in the circumstance, he is able and in fact will work for good if we love him and if we are moving according to the call which accords with his purpose. That means moving in his plan for us. You need to remember this. I'm thinking of St. Paul. Languishing in prison. Well, the Lord had said to him, "Paul, I'm going to send you before kings and rulers, and you're going to preach my name among the Gentiles." And here he is languishing in prison. If he were an average Christian, he would have bitten his fingernails to the elbows, and he would say, "Satan has done this to me, and Satan's after me, and that's why I'm here in prison." He didn't do that. You know what he did? He used the time to write some letters. Four of them. Four of the best letters of the New Testament. I don't think he didn't know he was doing that. You understood? He just thought he'd catch up in his correspondence. And he was building the church. He was speaking to kings and millions of people who didn't know him. And he might not ever have gotten around to write those letters had he not had the leisure of a prison cell. But you know what he said? He recognized it. And he said, "I'm a prisoner of the Lord Jesus Christ. I'm not even a prisoner of Rome. I'm a prisoner of the Lord Jesus Christ." Why? Because his God was the God of circumstances. And he knew he was following the Lord. He was pursuing what God had told him to do, and he ended up in prison. Well, prison is the place to be if God sets that across your path in obedience to him. Better be in prison with God than out of prison without him. I'm thinking of Joseph. Now, Joseph was the favorite of his father. You remember this. His father made him that fancy little coat he liked to prance around in. Another thing about him, he was always having dreams. And he was the hero of every dream. One day, it is reported that he carried lunch out to his brothers who were working in the fields. And he said to them as they munched on their sandwiches, I had a dream last night. It was of 12 haystacks, and 11 of them fell over and did obeisance to the 12th. Guess what, fellows? I'm the 12th. They hated him. They wanted to kill him. Reuben persuaded them not to do that, but rather to sell him to a passing caravan. And by a strange set of circumstances, he ended up as prime minister of Egypt. Years later, when his brothers came down to buy food, they didn't recognize him. Why should they? I mean, they weren't looking for him. Certainly not there. But he recognized them at once. But he didn't tell him who he was for some time. When he did, he said this to them, "You meant it to me for evil." And it was evil. It was motivated by jealousy and hatred. It was evil. There wasn't anything good about it. But God meant it to me for good. Even the evil that other people perpetrate on you can itself be redeemed by the power of our God, who's the God of all the circumstances. Do you understand? I'm thinking of a passage in the New Testament that adds another dimension to this. This whole thing, this whole scene is described by St. Paul in a brief way in 1 Corinthians 10. Let me just read it to you. I want you to know, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud. They were all baptized into Moses. They all ate the same supernatural food. They drank the same supernatural drink. Verse 5, nevertheless, with most of them, God was not pleased. He's talking about the children of Israel in the wilderness. With most of them, he was not pleased. Verse 11 is the verse I really want to call to your attention. Now, these things happened to them as a warning, but they were written down for our instruction, upon whom the end of the ages has come. Happened to them for a warning, but they were written down for us. Are you and am I able to learn from the experience of other people? Are we so stupid that we have to find everything out for ourselves? Aren't we able to learn what happened to them when they got into a jam, even though they were walking as the Lord was leading? That God knew what he was going to do with them there, even though they didn't know it. And can't we remind ourselves in difficult times that God knows what he's doing? I'm to look to him, not to lament my own ignorance or inability to cope. I simply look to the Lord. My ways are in his hands. Can we learn from the experience of others? I want to conclude quickly with a commentary on this whole thing from the Psalms. It's from Psalm 78, and I'm just going to call to your attention five little statements. It's a description of these people. I want you to think of it in terms of your own life. Psalm 78, quickly, five things that it says about them. Verse 11, they forgot what God had done and the miracles he had shown them. That's their first problem. They forgot. Nobody said, do you remember how God parted the sea and delivered us? Or in the chapter just before 17, how God provided us bread and meat in the wilderness? Nobody seemed to recall that. And so when they ran out of water, it was as though they'd never had a calamity before from which they were delivered. They forgot what God had done and the miracles that he had performed for them. 2, verse 18. They tested God in their heart by demanding the food they craved. They spoke against God, saying, can God spread a table in the wilderness? Can he also give bread or provide meat for his people? They tested God. They tested his power, his willingness. They said, can God do this? Is God able to do this? That's blasphemous, people. The God we're talking about is able to provide for his own and to care for them in any and all circumstances. Verse 22, because they had no faith in God and did not trust his saving power, They didn't remember him. They didn't remember what he had done. They tested and tempted God, and they had no faith in him. Fourth, verse 37, their heart was not steadfast toward him. They were not true to his covenant. They had fickle hearts, on again, off again. One day they're for him, and the next day they're against him. One day they're praising him and celebrating his glory, and the next day they're rejecting him and questioning his power. And finally, verse 42, they did not keep in mind his power. People, I want you to think of your life. Most of the people here have committed their lives to Jesus Christ. And it's not all roses, is it? It's not always a smooth path. Sometimes it's very difficult. And sometimes you feel as though you're abandoned. Is God with us or not? Well, don't be like the children of Israel who forgot what God had done for them in the past. Remember, it's by the mercy of God that you're even here this morning, that you have the willingness, the desire, and the opportunity to be in the house of the Lord, that God has brought you to this point. Remember that, and don't forget. Don't tempt God and test him and question whether or not he's able to provide for you or to care for you. That's blasphemy. Have faith in him and his provision. Let your heart be steadfastly anchored in the Lord and believe in his power and watch God work.